From KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
This week it's the food show. We're talking about the policies, the politics of food.
Because it seems something that's merely a personal choice, what you decide to eat, actually has much wider implications today.
And it's funny that we're doing this show on food because a little known fact is that Off Topic began as a show that was supposed to be about food.
Really?
Yeah. The idea behind it was to bring the energy, the strong opinions, the unrepentant forwardness of AM talk radio into national public radio, was to sort of combine sports talk radio, if you will, mm-hmm. with the Splendid Table. I thought it was a great idea. I thought people were going to love it. I thought it was going to be a success. It wasn't. But we do have the pilot that we recorded of the show. And so let's have a quick listen to the Off Topic that wasn't.
Stephen Hayward, Idris Goodwin.
All right, celery.
Yeah, celery's just not going to be a contender. I mean, has anyone ever taken celery seriously as a vegetable? I mean, you throw it in your Bloody Mary, you throw some peanut butter on it, but, you know, you don't ever, they're like the clippers.
What about pears? You think pears are going to do it? Is this going to be the year for pears is what I'm saying?
I don't think this is going to be the year for pears, but they're always the fruit to watch, I think.
No, this is the problem. This is the problem. If you had said to me 12 years ago, pears are the next fruit, I would have said yes. I would have said yes, yes, Idris. Pears are the next fruit, but pears have not brought it. Apples have brought it.
I think apples have definitely brought it.
Am I wrong? Am I wrong about apples?
You're not wrong.
Am I wrong about apples?
I'm trying to tell you.
Tell me if I'm wrong about apples.
You're not wrong about apples. What I'm saying is you're right about apples.
Tell me about couscous.
I mean, really, what is there to say about couscous? I mean, it's a
lackluster. What's your beef with couscous?
It's a lackluster grain.
Do you have a beef with couscous?
The sandy kind with the golden raisins? I mean, what is that? That's not going to fill me up. That's not going to take me through a full evening, you know what I mean, into overtime. It's not going to happen.
The problem with couscous, I'll tell you what it is right now. Couscous needs to sit down in front of the mirror and say to itself, what am I?
Well, it's not a food, Stephen, is what I contend. Is
that couscous
even should not even be, I think it's gravel, basically.
Hayward, food fire.
You know, Steve, I think it's probably just as well you decide to go a different way.
Yes, it is. It is good that we did not go that way. Let's do our thing instead. Let's do the food episode of Off Topic. Let's start talking about the industrialization of the food industry in the United States.
Right, because one of the things we think of when we think about food is, oh, you take some seeds, you plant it in the ground, you grow it, grandma and grandpa are out there digging up the turnips, and that's how food happens. But that is so far removed from the way most food is produced today as to be on a different food planet.
Do you eat organic?
I try to. Actually, I have a garden in my backyard. I understand that the meth runoff from my neighbor's laboratory may cause some. We got some strange cucumbers going on back there.
You know, when I was at Cornell, I lived sort of down the road from this organic chicken farm, and I got to be friends with the farmer who, every time I saw him, he would talk about how well his chickens were being treated. He was uh-huh. talking about, you know, these are chickens. There's no cages. They've never seen a cage. They can watch television. They can get as much feed as they want. And I always was wondering, like, how far would it go? I expected him to say, not only is this a chicken who grew up around Cornell, this is a chicken that attended Cornell. This is a chicken that got a B+ in Carl Sagan's astronomy class. This is a chicken that has hopes and dreams and wishes for the future. It is exactly like a human being. And let me tell you, there is nothing more delicious than a chicken that has got a B+ in medieval history. You know, I was joking, of course, but part of me was wondering, is that the direction that we're going in general in food production?
Right. Well, you know, I talked to Winona Howder, who's the author of Foodopoly. And while that sort of artisanal production of food local, free range, yeah. organic, is a direction that some food is going in the United States in response to large scale mass production. The reality is still the vast majority of the food we eat is produced in very, very different circumstances.
So exactly the opposite extreme.
Exactly the opposite extreme. So we're talking centralization and mass production. One of the things that you talk about in your book is that we've really had a transformation in the economy of the way food is produced over the past few decades. Can you tell me a little bit about how that transformation has worked?
Yes, well, it has been something that's happened over really the past 50 years. We had a system put in place during the 1930s that worked pretty well for consumers and farmers. But over the course of a number of years, it was chipped away for the benefit of the grain traders, the processed food industry, and actually a group of business leaders who believed that we had too many farmers and that there was a need for cheap labor in urban areas of the country. And in writing Foodopoly, I actually read some of the documents. They formed an organization called the Committee for Economic Development. And they really worked with the Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration, and all of the administrations after that to really change the policies that affect how food is grown, because it means in the food industry and in fact every industry, just a few companies control every aspect of the industry. And that means that they have been able to gain enormous political power. And in fact, today, we see a handful of companies in every industry actually dictating federal policy through our system of campaign contributions and all of the ways that corporations influence policy.
Right. And it seems that one of the interesting things about your work is that you do focus on things like political decisions made at the very highest level, rather than what we usually hear is, oh, the greedy farmers with their subsidies growing all that corn, they're the ones who are ruining our diets.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm afraid it's kind of an easy shot, especially for urban people who don't understand how difficult it is to grow food and how the inability of farmers to have a fair market really affects their how they're able to make a living. And our federal policies have basically dictated to farmers what they can grow. And most farmers are not making a very good living today, even though we hear constantly about the subsidies and that farmers are living high on the hog. And I think that farmers have just been an easy shot. When we really see who's benefiting from how our food is produced, it's the agrochemical companies like Monsanto, it's the food processing companies, it's the grocery industry, it's the grain traders, all of these companies that have really lobbied for the policies. And those are some of the structural changes that need to be made. I mean, we need to make common cause with farmers who I kind of view as victims of the food system.
Right. As a matter of fact, you discuss, for example, chicken farmers who have so little control over what happens on their farms that you say they basically are working as serfs.
That's right. You know, the vertically integrated chicken industry with companies like Tyson, Purdue, they control how chickens are grown, from the genetics to the chicks that they provide to the contract growers, to the arsenic and antibiotic-laced feed, to going and actually picking up the chickens in their trucks after the broilers are raised for 45 days, and then taking them to their facilities to be slaughtered And most recently, they've influenced the USDA to allow birds to be slaughtered at 175 minutes, or 175 birds per minute, rather. And then these companies also own the brand. The growers have to borrow the money for the large warehouses where the chickens are grown, and so these companies don't have to put up that capital. And these growers are stuck with these horrendous contracts that give them very little control over how their farm is run. And in fact, the big integrators go in and make a lot of those decisions. And one of these contract growers, they make on average between $12,000 and $15,000 a year, and they have liability for all of that, those huge amounts of waste from having 100,000 to 300,000 birds in one of these warehouses. And the chickens and the contract growers are really victims of this system. And some of the growers have actually come out recently, and they do call themselves serfs. That's not something I made up. That's how some of these growers refer to themselves. But mostly the growers are afraid to come forward because they know they'll lose their farm. They often borrow the money for these warehouses because they've made a lot of promises. It's often a last-ditch effort to save the farm, and they're really locked into this dreadful system.
And this seems like something that we would expect politicians and legislatures to address, and we don't see that. We don't see people in power, say in Washington, coming to the aid of small farmers.
No, we really don't. We hear a lot of rhetoric. It's sad, but President Obama promised to do something about the consolidated meat industry and the effect, on the contract growers for chicken and for a lot of other livestock growers that don't have a fair market, and we're losing these independent livestock growers and just moving completely to factory farming. And the Obama administration began the process to look at these issues. They held hearings around the country during the first term. But before they could make a decision, the meat industry started running ads about how Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack was a job killer, and the Obama administration chickened out, so to speak, and didn't take any meaningful action. And in fact, we haven't seen the Obama administration do the things that they promised, like to label genetically engineered food. The food industry is just so enormously powerful.
So this has a special layer of irony, given Michelle Obama's emphasis on especially healthy eating, and she has the garden on the lawn at the White House and those things. But it seems that there's a real disconnect there.
Well, that's right, because I think it's easy to talk about growing food yourself and taking personal action, but political leaders don't want to talk about the changes that need to be made that affect the economic system and that actually are benefiting the wealthiest among us.
That was Winona Howder, the author of Foodopoly. She'll be presenting a lecture September 19th at the Celeste Theater at the Cornerstone Arts Building on the Colorado College campus.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
This is the food episode. We're talking about the politics and the policies of food production in America today. And I think that one of the questions that a lot of people have, or when you come to try to think about this problem, is difficulty in imagining it. We've all heard the phrase industrialization of food production, but it's very abstract. What does it actually mean on an everyday basis, the industrialization of food?
Right. And so that's exactly the sort of question that interested journalist Ted Conover, who went undercover as a meat inspector in a Cargill beef processing plant in Nebraska and wrote an article for Harper's Magazine about his experiences that came out last spring. We talked to him about exactly what goes on. What do you see when you walk in the door? What goes on in these giant industrial meat processing plants?
It's a big place. There are a couple of thousand people who work there, and every day there are more than 5,000 cattle killed there. The cattle arrive in trailers holding about 40 each all day long. These trailers pull up, cattle are put into chutes, and one by one they go up a ramp designed by Temple Grandin, and they get knocked, which means they go through a hole into the building, and a guy places a captive bolt gun against their forehead, which, as they put it, renders them insensate. It basically kills them, but not completely. So their hearts will keep beating for a while, which is important to getting the blood out of the body. And simultaneously, a guy attaches a big cuff at the end of a chain around a rear leg of the animal, and it's hoisted aloft and begins a trip around what's called the kill floor, which is a very large room. It's about the size of a football field. And it begins a process of disassembly. There's a person or two at each station. One of them's clipping off the hooves. One of them's making a cut in the hide. My job as an inspector began on this sort of sub-chain, which is for heads and tongues, which are hung on alternate hooks as soon as the head is severed from the body. And inspectors like me would check lymph nodes for signs of infection. The main part of the body of the animal then gets opened up and its organs are dumped onto something called the viscera table. And that's another inspection point. And then with its organs removed, the animal is bisected from tail to sternum, essentially, with these hydraulic saws that are on platforms, and the operators go up and down, cut the animal in half. And again, piece by piece, the carcass is trimmed, fat is taken off, and everything it's sprayed by hot water to kill bacteria. And the final inspection point where I also worked is called the rail. And with a meat hook, you stand on a platform and you look at this carcass before it goes into a different part of the factory to cool off.
You know, it's interesting because when we think about the horrors of the food industry, especially the meat industry, we think this is going to be a story of corruption. This is going to be a story of lazy meat inspectors who are not doing their job. And you didn't find that at all. This is not a story of bad guys.
Well, and again, that kind of surprised me. I thought I'd see some vermin. I thought I'd see contamination, along the lines of the jungle where bad things are visibly added to meat. And instead, what you have in this century, in this country, is highly rationalized industrial processes, you know, which are designed all about keeping bacteria off and out. And there's various levels of quality control. And so, in a certain way, the meat is wholesome. That is, if some excreta, as they call it, makes its way to the carcass and I miss it, either the next inspector is going to see it or a Cargill quality assurance person is going to see it. Because as you can imagine, they don't want bad stuff leaving the plant with their name on it. But what you don't see, or what's harder to see, are the other bad things around meat production. Often the animals are not well. They've been bruised. Heifers that are supposed to never have given birth contain fetuses, which shocked me the first time I saw it. I thought I was looking at a dog on the viscera table, and I was just shocked because no one had told me I would be seeing that. And you realize that these animals, you know, maybe the last 15 or 20 seconds of their lives have been improved by this humane ramp that doesn't have sharp corners or bright lights, and it eases them to their death. But the months that come before that, you know, I think like most food animals, it's not so great. The last weeks are spent in these feedlots where they're given grain that marbles the flesh and makes them delicious, but it's not good for their stomachs. And we use drugs to try to fix that instead of giving them a healthier life. And so there are things you can see from being an inspector, and then there's other things you can't see, and you have to infer.
Right. And there also seems to be a pushback, especially from big agricultural companies, about this kind of knowledge or writing about the industry, giving the consumers information. So I'm specifically thinking about the ag gag laws that are going into effect all over the United States, actually.
Yeah. So it's really fascinating because I do think that beef and pork and chicken producers feel themselves under siege. And it's a direct result of this, of consumer awareness of production, of the slow food movement, of the writings of Michael Pollan that make people think about where all this food comes from and what were the conditions of production, and the organic foods movement. Especially urban consumers want a different product than producers are used to making. And they're very sensitive about critiques of their procedures. And they're super, super sensitive about activists coming in, especially with hidden cameras, and taking pictures of some of the bad things that go on. So yeah, the ag gag laws are trying to kill the messenger, when I think the smarter approach from just a business perspective might be to improve transparency and not get so angry when somebody does what PETA or Mercy for Animals does. And they just kind of seem out of touch with the way the wind is blowing on food production. I think as a culture, all the signs are we want to do it better. And in fact, more and more people are demanding it be done better. And there's a lot of defensiveness and feelings of persecution about it. You know, the industry for years has congratulated itself on the incredible efficiencies and productivity. And now I think it seems quite unfair to them that they're being judged on this other metric of wholesomeness by, let's admit, a more upscale consumer who might be willing to pay more for better food.
Right. And you also found, and that leads into this question, you found a real urban-rural divide, it seemed, between about people's attitudes towards food, or maybe it's a divide around socioeconomic class or educational level. But there was a feeling, it seemed to me, in your article among the workers you talked to, that a lot of people, especially in urban areas, are kind of are going too far with this idea about food safety, or they're being just a little too sensitive about it.
Well, yeah. There was this great moment when one of my colleagues was reading Every Day with Rachel Ray, the food magazine, during our break, and she just guffawed in amusement at a quote from somebody in New York who was saying she only wanted her beef organic and humanely raised. And my fellow inspector said, "What does this mean, humanely raised? Does this mean you scratch the cow behind the ears and sing it a song at night? Is that what these city people think?" She said, "Organic and humanely raised have nothing to do with each other, and I don't even know what humanely raised means." And I must say, she might have a point. And even if you are buying your meat from a farm that raises it in a less sort of corporate and industrial way, what's humane about turning that animal into a piece of meat you're going to eat anyway? The word seems misapplied. And so I don't know. I would love for my next project to be something about this gap, this way city people and country people are not understanding each other when we talk about making food.
Right. What about an economic impact of this, about the difference between, say, industrial corporate farming and smaller traditional ranches, not only in terms of, you know, in terms of not just how the animals are treated, but say, for example, how the environment is treated, and even more importantly, how workers are treated?
I suppose everybody in their heart prefers the model of a smaller farm, you know, with friendlier management and everything a nicer scale. But I think one problem with the status quo is how people who really can't afford to buy organic products are sometimes made to feel they're not, you know, doing the best for their families. They're not caring enough to buy milk that costs $4.25. I don't even know if that's a gallon or half gallon. I guess it's a half gallon.
Probably a half gallon when
you could be buying the same quantity of regular milk for $2 and something. And so this is another problem with our conversation is people with more money can afford to eat better and aren't always thinking about health from the perspective of someone who really has to watch their paycheck.
That was journalist and author Ted Conover talking about his experiences in a major meat processing plant.
You can find his story in Harper's under the title The Way of All Flesh. This is Off Topic. It's the food episode. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. This is the food episode. We're talking today about the politics of food production in America.
We live in a capitalist system. The laws of economy of scale mean that there is an economic reality to industrialization, to centralization, to mass production of food.
I spoke to Mike Calicrate. He's a cattleman, a longtime cattleman and owner of Ranch Foods Direct, about the economic realities of food production and about how producing locally makes a lot of economic sense, not just in terms of producing beef in a more efficient and less costly way, but also in terms of the wider economic ramifications, the ways in which food production affects the whole community.
As a note of disclosure, Ranch Foods Direct, which is based here in Colorado Springs, is an underwriter of KRCC.
Industrial agriculture is about an extraction model. It's you want everything something will give, and you want it now, and you want maximum returns on investment. You want maximum throughput in the capital asset.
Right.
If it's a hog barn with concrete and steel, you want all the hogs through there that you can possibly get. That means stacking them in, crowding them in, doing whatever you had to do. You didn't care about the humane impact on the animal. You simply cared about money, and that's about it.
Right.
And you didn't care about your community. You were happy to stand on the neck of your neighbor to make a buck. It's like the rancher farmer that said, you know, I don't want to own all the land. I just want to own what joins me. And the question then becomes, when do you need your neighbor more than you need his land, more than you need his livestock?
Yeah.
Is it when the church goes out of business? Is it when the school goes empty? Is it when the grocery store closes on Main Street? I don't know. When is that?
Well.
And so you start thinking more about community and longevity. You start thinking about kids and grandkids and what are you going to leave for them? You know, are you going to leave them a carcass of what used to be a thriving industry that with the bones picked completely clean? And of course, then the dollar stores come in after Walmart's done their thing to a community, and they consume the decaying remains. And nothing is left when they go. And this is the model of industrial agriculture. It's very comparable to the model of Walmart.
Right.
It's an extraction model that does not care about husbandry. Husbandry is the proper care of an animal. But the difference really is corporate-controlled agriculture supports industrial agriculture. Family farm agriculture would support animal husbandry and good stewardship. Good stewardship is about leaving the land better than you found it. Good stewardship is about combining crop and animal agriculture on the same farm and feeding crops to livestock and the manure going back on the land to build soil and make it better. Industrial agriculture is about mining the land. It's about using chemical fertilizers to maximize yield as soil quality declines and soil erodes. And we end up with all this fertilizer, nitrogen, and stuff in the Gulf of Mexico, right down the Mississippi River from Iowa. You know, that's industrial agriculture. And so I made that transition from industrial agriculture to family farm and type operations where we practice animal husbandry. And so this is what I promote: animal husbandry, good stewardship, food that doesn't kill you. You know, I would love it if we could go into a restaurant and if you ate bad food, you could die in the chair. Mm-hmm. I mean, wouldn't it be great if when you eat food that's going to kill you eventually, if you could die right away?
Immediately after.
That way, when the next guy walks in, he'd know what to order because you simply go and check the dead guy. You know, what did he have? And don't order that. You know, and try to order food that doesn't kill you. But what we have today is all kinds of foods that are out there. Most of the food you eat today kills you. It's got the high fructose corn syrup, which is another industrial disaster. It's got hydrogenated vegetable oil, another industrial disaster on our health. I mean, we're talking cancer, diabetes, obesity. I mean, we got all kinds of degenerative disease. Look at what's going on with our joints. These orthopedic guys are loving it. We've got a healthcare system now that's costing us more than we can ever afford to pay. And if we can just get back to eating really good food again, and taking care of those people, making sure that those people who produce our food are fairly compensated, to where as we go down the road into the future, our children have the ability to eat good food and be supported by a good, healthy, and thriving farm community. That's what I'm about.
Well, what about these people? You talk about fair compensation. You talk about affordability. And what do you tell people? I mean, one of the things you talk about how the world would be a different place. I think a lot of people have trouble imagining that, about imagining the financial sustainability of husbandry. Can you talk a little bit about that financial sustainability?
Well, actually, the financial stability and sustainability of a family farm operation where animals are treated humanely in a very sustainable and, you know, with good animal husbandry and stewardship is a far more successful financial model than the industrial approach. The industrial approach, as we talked, is extractive. It's like mining. When the mine is mined, you're done. It's over. But when you produce livestock and crops together on a farm and the manure goes on the land and the crop goes in the livestock, it's amazing the amount of food that you can produce and at a lower price, actually more efficiently. For example, in St. Francis, Kansas, we have got a mobile slaughter unit. 4 people have the capacity to kill 20 animals per day. That's 5 animals per person per day that they can process. At IBP in Garden City, Kansas, one of the biggest meat slaughter plants in the country, it's now owned by Tyson. They've got 2,500 workers that process 5,000 cattle per day. That's 2 animals per man. That's less than half of the animals that we get through our mobile slaughter unit. They box their beef. That does not include boxing, though, at St. Francis. We have to bring that to Colorado Springs to box the beef. But we don't box most of it. Most of it gets cut right into the final cut, right into the grocery store type of retail cut, which we have, the grocery store or the meat market at Ranch Foods. And we go directly into the school lunch program. So we're not, and we're going to restaurant cuts. And so we're not boxing all this meat that IBP and Cargill and now JBS bought Conagra.
Sure.
That they're, and we're bypassing an entire step.
You're going straight to the consumer.
And we are way better retail cutters than anyone in the major retail business, because this is what our guys are really trained at. And so we're more efficient, and we pay a living wage to our workers. So we don't externalize that person's life and cost of living onto the community that we live in. So in other words, our workers aren't down at the welfare office looking for the balance of what it takes to feed a family. They're not down at the hospital not paying their bill when they got injured at the packing plant, the IBP plant. We're not externalizing costs, is my point. So, yeah, you may go to the grocery store and think you bought something cheap, But hey, it is far from cheap when you add the entire total bill up, and that includes all of the costs that they externalized. Today, in the biggest meatpacking plants, on average, you have to speak 110 languages to communicate. These are refugee laborers that come here under special work visa provisions as refugees, war refugees, right, whatever, economic refugees. These are people who are exploited not only where they came from and have suffered hardship, but they come here and get to suffer a lot more.
Is that, yeah,
working for the big meat packers. And of course, they have no power. They don't want them joining unions. They don't want them getting a fair wage. And so this is what the big boys depend upon to put more money to the bottom line for the few that own the company or that work in the high levels of management of the company. And so there's all kinds of examples like that. And if you want to know how to grow food to feed the world, it's done with people on the land, not Monsanto seed, Monsanto's chemicals, and Cargill's tractor drivers. It's done with people on the land, caring for the land, and taking care of the soil and growing this food. And we just need to let people have land again. You know, we're back to the lord and tenant sharecropper, yeah, relationship that we left from Europe when we formed our country. We're back again. So the rich guys own the land, and the rest of the people are driving a tractor for them or doing a tenant farming arrangement where they get to go bankrupt. And you know, the landlord is the only guy that wins in this thing, or the big packer or the big retail store or whatever. And so, you know, I'm all about trying to create this alternative food system. Well, Ranch Foods Direct is a critical piece of that, because you've got to be able to have the infrastructure to process an animal from where it's produced to get the meat to the consumer.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, you know, we focus on humane treatment of livestock. You know, the other thing, when we talk about killing an animal in a mobile slaughter unit in St. Francis, Kansas, where they're at, they don't get on a truck and travel a couple hundred miles. Some animals today are traveling 600 miles to the market because the packers are gone out of business where they live, and they have no choice but to pay the freight to get these animals to market. That's become a huge expense. But think about the welfare of the animal having to take that long ride. It's fearful. They shrink a lot. It's very, very stressful on those animals. If you kill an animal where it is at, if you process it in its home, basically, and you do it humanely and you handle it humanely, this animal's meat is better. It tastes better. It's more tender. It's a better product. So we've got all kinds of things we can talk about when we beat industrial agriculture in the family farm, you know, local community kind of model. Beat them every time. They cannot compete with that. The problem is we can't externalize costs. We can't go to the government and say, hey, we need a farm program that makes corn cheap so that we can get a deal on corn, so that we can pay a dollar, maybe $2 below the actual cost of production. Government, why don't you pay these farmers a bunch of money so that Tyson, Cargill, and JBS can get some cheap feed for their cattle? That's precisely what's gone on in these farm bills, because these big corporations own Congress. They get their way. We have a government of the corporations. We have the government of Wall Street today. And so when we talk about building the alternative local regional food system, we're really talking about decoupling and getting outside of this Walmart kind of extraction sort of economy. And as we sit here today in Colorado Springs, this is an economy that has a very, very heavy parasite load. You know what I mean by parasites?
What do you mean by that? Yeah.
If your dog has a lot of worms, what happens? He starts looking sick, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, his hair gets rough and some of it falls out, and he's real listless and he's not feeling good, right? So what do? I mean, you figure out what's wrong. Well, he's got these parasites. He's got fleas. He's got worms. He's got all kinds of things that's sucking the nutrients from his body, and he's turning into this animal that's sickly and not healthy anymore. He can't support the parasite load. There's too many things sucking the nutrients from him. In Colorado Springs, what we have is that kind of a parasite load, except that it's fast food restaurants. It's big box stores. Perhaps it's a retired military community that doesn't work anymore. All they do is cash their government checks, which is nice. I mean, they get to spend it in the community, and we want them to live comfortably and retire in good shape. But we need job creation here. We need people who create wealth and make stuff and grow things and bring wealth to our community rather than taking wealth from our community. And so you can talk about, you know, other ways.
So that, then a big box store would be a parasite in the sense that it's located here,
right,
but the wealth doesn't go back into the
exactly. Into the they sell things from somewhere else and take the money away every day. And that's a big box store. And that's any national chain restaurant. That's any fast food restaurant. They sell stuff from somewhere else and take the money away. They do leave behind some minimum wage.
Yeah.
And don't pay the full living wage. And again, as a result, externalize costs on the community. And they sell food that kills you. So there's all kinds of problems with these, with this industrial model of food production, processing, and distribution.
That was Mike Calicrate, noted cattleman and food activist. This is Off Topic. It's the food episode. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward. It's the food episode. We're talking about the politics and the policies of food production in America.
And you know, Steve, one of the things I think about when I'm listening to Mr. Calicrate talk is how, yes, I can buy this food, this terrific food, for my family. But it becomes a whole different issue when we're talking about feeding, for example, thousands of school children in the local school district.
No, I think that's right. I mean, it's one thing to have organic food production, eating well, eating with a conscience as being a theoretical proposition. But can you do it? Can you feed thousands of school children in that manner? This is exactly what I wanted to ask Rick Hughes. He's director of food and nutrition services here in Colorado Springs, School District 11. He's spearheading something called the Good Food Project.
Because if it seems that there's any group of people we want to make sure have good food, it's our children.
Why don't we start off by you telling us what is different about your approach to school food?
It was about in 2007 we began the D11 Good Food Project, which is our effort to bring healthy, sustainable, fresh food to schools for kids. And it's really a different mindset of doing what's best for kids and what's best for the health of our community to be able to serve that fresh food. And with that mindset, you know, really everything is kind of falling into place like we wanted it to.
Sure.
And so it's very cool, very exciting.
So when you say it's a different mindset, are you talking about just like we'll care about the what our kids are eating, or is it more practical than that?
It's really about getting kids to like healthy, fresh food, to move kids away from a diet of mostly fat, mostly sugar, and mostly salt to eating foods that are fresh and don't contain preservatives and artificial dyes and things like that. So food that's more natural or whole is really what we're trying to serve our kids in our city.
All right, so give me like a sort of an example of a menu.
Well, you know,
substitute.
In the old days, you know, it used to be chicken nuggets,
oh, yeah.
Nachos with the glowing yellow cheese sauce,
pizza. You're making me hungry.
You know, and it's not that way anymore. Instead, now it's chicken tenders. It's all natural grass-fed beef. It is lasagna made from scratch. It's macaroni and cheese made from scratch with a squash, winter squash, pureed into the cheese sauce. The kids don't even know it's there. It's that stealth health thing. And it's so good. It's like the macaroni and cheese that my mom used to make. And we have an executive chef who's amazing. We have a dietitian who's amazing. We have an assistant food service director that helps me put all these programs into place. Really, I've got a fantastic team, and they're the ones that help put this great food into our schools.
Can you talk a little bit about the way in which the kinds of things that you're doing right now with school lunches fits into the wider evolution of what the school lunch is?
Sure. I started in school food service in 1991, you know, so in those 22 years, you know, the school lunch program began like in the 1950s and kind of evolved from serving healthy, fresh, scratch-cooked foods only to a very, very profit-driven system. Mm-hmm. And in that food system, which really kind of epitomizes what we have in our country today, that has kind of changed the landscape of schools to the extent that kitchens that were built in the you know, the 50s and 60s, you know, were pretty good size. Kitchens that were built in the 80s and 90s were built much smaller because it's now a convenience menu. It's now a heat and serve, chicken nuggets, chicken patties, frozen pizza type of menu, to now where we're coming back and we're saying, gosh, we wish we had more of those kitchens that were built in the 1960s and 70s. Because we're now, you know, preparing food from scratch again. I was at a school today, and I had this scratch-made biscotti that was served with an all-natural yogurt, fresh fruits and vegetables, and milk, and it was a fantastic lunch. And we're able to do that on our whopping budget of $2.78 on average to produce a school meal. And out of that $2.78, I need to cover electricity, I need to cover the depreciation on the equipment that I'm using, I need to cover the insurance costs for my employees, I need to pay my employees a salary that's fair. I need to buy good natural food. And, you know, when was the last time you bought a lunch and did all that and was able to produce a complete meal for $2.78? It's nearly impossible, but we're able to move things around, you know, as far as the budget. For example, I can buy local beans, local meat, local tortilla. Yeah. And make an incredible sauce for it and build my own burrito much cheaper than I can buy a frozen burrito that had to come from Wisconsin or someplace.
Is that right? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people, including myself, think the opposite is true. Think that if you're going to make scratch-made food, that what you're getting to is all kinds of auxiliary costs. But that's not the case.
It really nets out at zero. I can do the exact same with a better tasting, healthier, fresher product at the same price or lower than I could buy a convenience food item that's been trucked across the country.
In terms of the meal modification that you're doing, is it more important to have food that is sustainably grown, or is it more important to make the food, say, from scratch? How do you organize that hierarchy of what your intervention is?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, when I consider that my budget to produce a meal is an average $2.78 of revenue, it ultimately comes down to what can I get the biggest bang for the buck? And my biggest bang is children's health. And so when I focus on children's health and I purchase the best foods possible and the sustainability piece, really transportation is what we're talking about. Am I buying an apple from Washington or am I buying an apple from the western slope of Colorado? If I can buy an apple from the western slope of Colorado and make that work in my meal price, I will buy that apple every time from our local farms. That takes work sometimes for me to do that. Sometimes it's a lot of work because there's really several things that I have to consider. One is food safety. Does the vendor have good food safety controls from when that food is grown? I have to consider the liability of that product and whether or not they have the appropriate insurance and is that basically safe for me to serve?
Yeah.
And is it affordable? And then I have to have an open competitive process because we're using federal money to purchase that same apple. And so there's really a lot to consider. But if I can get that same apple for near the price of what I could buy at the best price possible, and even if it's a few cents more, if I can promote that apple as being local and it came from Swanson's Farm, let's say, or Palisade Peach Company. Yeah. We served organic Palisade peaches last school year as a special treat for kids. They were amazing. They had so much flavor, and they were a lot more expensive, probably 10 cents a serving more expensive. And because we promoted it as Palisade Peaches, our participation went through the roof that day.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. No. So we had more kids buying the meal, which offset the higher cost of that food item. And we promoted that it was from the Palisade Peach Company, and it was from Ellen Wilson's farm, peach orchards in Palisade, and we did this story for and it was really cool. And our participation went way up. We got an article written about it in the Denver Post where a reporter there there, talked to a teacher who had this experience with a child who had never had a fresh peach before.
Wow.
And how special that was. And just, you know, hearing that from a child's mind of how cool this is to be able to have this fresh food. It was really a neat story.
Incredible.
It was.
That was Rick Hughes, Director of Food and Nutrition Services, Colorado Springs School District 11. This is Off Topic. It's the food episode. This is Off Topic, and I'm Steve Hayward. As far as we might travel, and as much as we might think we change, it is the food of our childhood that stays with us. Those are the tastes that pluck us from the present and fling us into the past. For me, it's Big Macs, which never fail to remind me of my Aunt Daisy and her secret sauce for hamburgers. Daisy was my great aunt, the eldest sister of my paternal grandfather. She died 3 years ago at the age of 95. I found the recipe for her secret sauce a week after that, when we were in the process of cleaning out her apartment in Toronto. The recipe was on the back of an index card, nestled among yellowed newspaper clippings and unusable coupons. The idea of a secret sauce, and more specifically of a secret sauce that could transform hamburgers, is, of course, a trademark of the McDonald's Corporation. As a child of the 1970s, I'm old enough to remember a time when McDonald's was just one of many fast food restaurants. This was something that changed in the 1970s after the appearance of the Big Mac. Invented by a Pennsylvanian named Jim Delgatti, the Big Mac combined extra thin patties, lettuce, special sauce, onion, cheese, and a sesame seed bun.
To all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
As anyone who has ever eaten a Big Mac knows, the essence of the Big Mac resides in the sauce. You might be able to get a sesame seed bun, you might be able to fashion yourself two extra thin patties, but the special sauce was something else entirely. You couldn't buy it, and you couldn't make it. You either had it or you didn't. It was as simple as that. The sauce was made to seem more secret and more special by virtue of the extent and expense to which McDonald's went to guard the secret of what was in the sauce and how it was made. Efforts on the part of the McDonald's Corporation were made to recover a cookbook they had distributed to their managerial staff. This cookbook contained, among other things, the secret of the special sauce. Carefully photographed raids took place across North America, in which serious-looking young men in suits and dark sunglasses took back copies of the cookbook from apparently renegade and sometimes confused managers. I'm not entirely sure that Aunt Daisy would want me to read her recipe for the secret sauce on the radio, but I like to think she would. I like to think of her as a social reformer, someone committed to leveling the playing field. "Steven," she would ask me, watching as I took my first bite of one of her hamburgers, "what do you think?" I knew she was asking about the sauce, and that she was saying, "keep hope alive. If we can beat the corporations, we can do anything." And so I'm going to read it now. Get ready. This is Aunt Daisy's secret sauce for hamburgers. I'll wait while you get a pencil. 3/4 cup Miracle Whip. 2 teaspoon sweet relish, drained. Let me just pause and admit that I've changed the word drained. The actual word Aunt Daisy used was trained. Although I know this to be a spelling mistake and that what Aunt Daisy meant to write was drained, the idea of differentiating between trained and untrained relish strikes me as something she would do. She told me once that not weeping at funerals was the chief virtue an older woman could have. I remember her at my uncle's funeral. He died one August afternoon in the supermarket parking lot after lifting a heavy bag of Macintosh apples into the trunk of his car. Aunt Daisy had already sat herself in the passenger seat and did not know what had happened until she got out of the car. The first thing she saw, she told me, were the apples rolling down the black pavement in a haphazard, frightening way, like a blood-colored ribbon. But let me get back to the recipe. Here it is now, again from the beginning. 3/4 cup Miracle Whip, 2 teaspoons sweet relish, drained, sugar and salt, 1 teaspoon mustard powder blended with 1 1/4 teaspoon cider vinegar, mix, thoughtfully. Those are the actual words Aunt Daisy wrote. Mix thoughtfully. Maybe she meant thoroughly. Probably she meant thoroughly. But maybe not. Maybe the point of her secret sauce was that moment when you stood there with your spatula and thought. Now, I have decided this sentence is not a message to me. And though I have told myself this, I'm not sure. Maybe Daisy had somehow foreseen it all. She died, after all, in the kitchen with the recipe box in her hand, the card spilling out across the floor when she fell. Maybe she knew the end was coming and made her way to the kitchen so she could pass away there, so she could drop onto a kitchen floor. No streaks, Stephen, she would tell me as she mixed the sauce, getting her shoulder into it. The secret of the special sauce is to make people think it's never been anything but sauce. And then she'd stop and put in more Miracle Whip. Don't you just love Miracle Whip, she'd ask me, and not wait for an answer. The tendency, of course, is not to replicate the special sauce, but to change it, to add as much Miracle Whip as you can stand. There was always too much Miracle Whip in Aunt Daisy's special sauce for hamburgers, and there's probably too much in mine. All the same, no one complains.
Off Topic is produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell with help from the Tim Gill Center for Public Media, a part of Rocky Mountain PBS, in association with Colorado College and KRCC in Colorado Springs.
For more information or to download any of our episodes, to download any part of this episode that you might have missed, you can find us at www.offtopicradio.org. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray.
And until next week, stay off topic.